Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and we are coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, July 26th, 2017. This is the 149th episode of the series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is an outstanding food and travel photographer, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to consider the freelance life. So most people prefer to have a steady job that provides security and perks, like insurance and vacation and sick days. And that is all wonderful. However, there are many advantages to being a freelancer. Freelancing provides flexibility and the opportunity to work on projects that inspire you and on your own terms. Sure, there are pros and cons to everything, and being a freelancer means you need to be a bit of a hustler and risk taker, but the rewards can be great. So if you believe in yourself and independence, give freelancing a try. It's a lifestyle worth pursuing. That's my tip today. Now, I'm thrilled to have my guest in the studio with me. It is Evan Sung. He is a prominent food, lifestyle, and travel photographer based in Brooklyn, whose work has taken him around the world. In addition to his long freelance tenure with the New York Times, Evan has traveled and photographed for clients like Vogue, The Wall Street Journal, GQ, Bon Appetit, Food & Wine, and Delta Sky. His work has also appeared in several recently published books with Michelin-starred chefs, including To the Bone with Chef Paul Liebrandt and North with Icelandic chef Gunnar Gislason. Welcome, Evan.
Thanks so much for having me, Sherry.
I'm really happy to have you. My pleasure. Your career and everything you've done in it is so impressive, and we've known each other a while in the industry and hopping around to restaurants.
Definitely.
So I want to find out how you became this amazing photographer, food and travel.
Well, definitely putting in a lot of time and just being really, persistent and present for. I think early on, you are just kind of working. I was a freelancer, so I was just working, and you sort of just take jobs as they come. And I don't know if I didn't have a grand strategy, but I did enjoy it, and I just kind of kept at it. And there was always this feeling that, like, after a few years, 3-4 years, people would see you, and they would say, "Oh, right, I remember you. You were here 2 years ago," or I saw you doing this other job. And I think it was that sense of, oh, right, you're still here and in it. And then people started to kind of like say, okay, right. So you're a fixture right in this universe, right? Because there are other people who I think maybe pass through this world and then maybe don't stick around because it's challenging and because there's only so many opportunities. And I think part of it was just being, showing up, right? Like just being present and being there and people sort of seeing that my work was continuing to spread and you know, be around. So
yeah, I can relate to that because I think it's the same with me doing PR, just sticking around and doing it and being out there. Mm-hmm. People now know that's what I do,
right.
And I'm consistent with it.
Right.
So, did you always want to be a photographer?
So no, I actually never touched a camera until after, or right at the end of college. Strangely, my grandfather was a very active amateur photographer. He really loved it, and I remember we would go visit my cousins in LA, and he would take pictures of us with all these funny filters. Mm-hmm. It was just something that I was aware of, but I wasn't so close to him. He was Taiwanese and spoke Taiwanese and Japanese, and I don't. So, but you know.
I don't either. That makes you feel better.
That does make me feel better. But anyway, so there was that sort of small tangential connection, but honestly, it never occurred to me to do anything like that. In college, I started studying psychology and really clicked with that. I really enjoyed all that material and psychoanalysis and all of those things. I just thought it was fascinating. It was a lot about storytelling, you know, it was a lot about the interpretation of dreams and kind of shaping that into a narrative. So I was all about that and literature, and like art history, but I never considered, you know, doing anything creative in that regard. And then I got a job at a bookshop, Shakespeare and Company, last year, and met a guy who became a good friend, named Shelton Wallsmith, who's a very talented, multidisciplinary artist. And, he and his girlfriend sort of became, they invited me over to their place a lot, and I loved his work. And he had an old camera, an old Yashica mat, which is sort of like a slight lower end Raleigh Flex, but you know, a twin lens reflex camera that you hold at your waist and you look down, and the whole world is sort of flipped in reverse on that ground glass. And something about that was so kind of mystical and cinematic. Yeah. I had never seen it before and asked him how it worked. And then we started, the three of us would go out and take pictures, and he really encouraged, my eye and just the sense of shoot everything, you know, shoot whatever you want and just allow that to be a creative process. And he had a small dark room, so we would print, at his apartment. And, so that was really it. It became something that I really enjoyed because of my relationship with them. And, so I put that on the back burner. It was just a hobby that I did, but I still was, I was actually determined to go to a PhD program in comparative literature. And I got in and I went to UC Irvine for about 6 months, but I kind of quickly realized that it wasn't for me exactly, even though it was a great program and a great school. And I was sort of at a crossroads in life at that point. This was like 99, 2000. So I had to really think about it and reevaluate what I would do. And I decided to give photography a shot, but I don't think I even really knew what that meant, except that I was going to go back to New York from California and just try and find a job in photography. And I did kind of quickly. I found a studio assistant job, which kind of quickly morphed into a sort of studio manager job. And I learned a lot. It was at a stock agency called Comstock. And, you know, so they would do sort of conceptual photos of doctors, you know, like holding notepads and just a lot of stock photography. But I learned a lot about production and lighting and all of these things. So that was sort of my graduate program in photography.
Right. Well, and then how did you get into food?
Right. So then I worked there for a while, and then I ended up going out to Paris. I had sort of done what I needed to do at that stock agency job and wanted to move on. And I had always wanted to go back to Paris. I'd studied there a bit and made friends there. And so
everyone always wants to go back to Paris.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it was seemed like a good time, and I went back. And the short version is that I met a guy who happened to be... who had happened to just lose his assistant, and so he was looking for an assistant. It was harder than I expected to actually find people who'd hire a photographer or an assistant from New York, mostly due to visa issues and stuff
in Paris. Okay. Yeah.
I think naively I thought it would be easier, but it took a while. But I met this guy, Giacomo Bretzel, who was a really fun, talented guy who shot everything, like food, beauty, lifestyle, cars, portraits, really just everything, you know. So, and we traveled a lot and just got, I got to see a lot of the world and just a different side of things through the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to, I mean, he still does. He loves working with older cameras and film. And this was still, like, digital was just kind of taking hold, but it wasn't established yet. So he had a real flair for all of that. But food was a big part of what he did. And so we ate well and we drank well, and I learned a great deal from him. And then when I left Paris after about a year and a half, I came back to New York and started to put a portfolio together of portraits. I was really always interested in portraits, which is kind of a tie to the psychology aspect, you know.
Right.
And one of the first things that, as I pitched my portfolio around, one of the first things I got hired to do was shoot a restaurant review. And I like to think that it was the original Momofuku noodle bar.
Mm-hmm.
But it probably wasn't the very first thing I did, but it was probably like the first five things I did.
Okay.
And, you know, that was such a
huge,
yeah, like a seismic shift in mm-hmm. what food media was and what food was. And I was just learning all of this stuff, but I was sent to shoot a review and I did it and they liked the results. And I realized I knew how to do it from working with Giacomo, and, it became a regular thing, you know, weekly. They would send me out to shoot reviews.
Who sent you?
This was the New York Sun.
Okay. I remember the Sun.
Which is no longer, but, you know, they had a great arts and culture section.
They did.
And it was definitely a training ground for people who went on to the Times and the Journal and all of that. So, but yeah, it was a great gig. And I got to shoot restaurants weekly and just learned a lot about the restaurant scene. And I think pretty quickly, probably like within 6 to 8 months, I was sending out, I would make these little postcards and promote, you know, my work and myself. And pretty quickly, I got a call from, I got a call on my phone, and I looked down at the phone, and it says 111-1111.
Yeah, and I've seen that one before.
Yes, I know you have. but of course, I had no idea what that was, mm-hmm. and I was at work at my day job at another studio, and I was like, I don't know if I should take this call, I don't know what it is, but something was like, it just compelled me to take it, and it was the New York Times. At the time, the photo editor of the dining section was Phaedra Brown, and she had gotten my card, one of my cards, and asked if I was free to shoot a restaurant review. And I'm pretty sure it was Chinatown Brasserie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I did that, of course. I was very happy to be asked and did that. And then it was kind of off and running from there. That was the Frank Bruni era.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, I don't know, something in the order of 75 to 80% of those like reviews, I think. It rotated, but I definitely was doing a lot of those restaurant reviews.
It's amazing. And when you go in, you're given an assignment of which dishes to shoot. Like, what's the process then like of shooting a restaurant?
Well, I mean, even with the Times, it was so different. So this would be like 2005, I suppose, 2005, 2006. And back then it was still just one photo that ran in the paper and online.
You
know, and usually it was a photo of the interior in service. So mm-hmm. like, you know, warm tone, blurry shots of the dining room. But then after a couple of years, Bruni started doing the interviews with Pete Wells. They did little slideshows. And so then I started to get assignments where it was like, go in, shoot, you know, these dishes, shoot the chef at work, shoot, you know, any number of things. So, and it continued to grow, you know, it was just a big thing. But that's what I mean. It was like, mm-hmm. food media was changing so much,
and
people wanted all these visuals and to kind of create stories that had just a broader rendition of what was going on in these restaurants. So,
yeah, I'm thinking, I don't know if there's a weird pressure or something that happens when you're going in to shoot for a restaurant review, and the chef doesn't know they know a review's coming out. but you don't know, they don't know what the review is going to be. Is that like an awkward or difficult thing to deal with at times?
I mean, people would ask if I knew.
And yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's happened, you know, it's happened where you photograph a review that ends up being a not great review. And obviously it has nothing to do with,
right.
with any photographer that goes in to any restaurant for a review purpose. But you know, there is always a feeling of like, oh, that's, it's too bad I had to photograph that one or mm-hmm. something like that. But, you know, of course the main goal is to go in and just make it look as good as possible. That's to make the nicest photos possible. So,
and I will say you certainly do that.
Thank you.
Your photos are beautiful. And on that note, we are going to take a little break and then we're going to come back and talk more with Evan. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Evan Song. He is a fantastic food, lifestyle, and travel photographer. And so we were just talking about shooting for the New York Times, which is amazing, as a regular freelancer. But another thing you do is you do all these beautiful cookbooks and work with so many chefs. So how did you get into that? Like, what was the first book you worked on?
So the very first book I worked on was, there was a woman that I met named Lauren Dean, who's a producer, who's still a very active and amazing producer. And she was producing a show called Cook Yourself Thin. And it was three women, and it was a Lifetime television show, a Lifetime series. And it was, they were working on a cookbook, you know, to sort of pair with that. And so I was asked to photograph that book. And it was my first experience. I was on this TV set, and they had set aside an area to shoot the dishes, and there was an amazing prop stylist who had this whole array of linens and plates and forks and knives, and a food stylist who was styling for TV. And so that was really my first experience shooting a cookbook. And it was a great first experience because all of that infrastructure was already there, mm-hmm. the stylists and, you know, a sense of what the book is supposed to be, et cetera. So that was my very first. and so I owe Lauren just a huge debt for offering me that opportunity.
Yeah.
But you know, beyond that, like in the last, I would say 5, 6, 7 years, the cookbook has just become a much bigger part of what I do. And, I was doing a few things, but the most important cookbook project that really sort of set things rolling was my relationship with Paul Liebrandt. And we had met when Cortone opened, and I was shooting for the Times and for Manhattan Magazine, you know, the usual mm-hmm. round of sort of opening press. And we started to work together. The story is that I had seen the Alinea cookbook come out. At that time, I'd been shooting already for a while. But when that cookbook came out, I was sort of blown away by the visuals. And now since then, of course, like I've seen, you know, Michelle Braz cookbooks and all of these things. But for me, that was at that time in my education and career, that was a revelation. And I started to think about how could I try and do work like this, and who plates food that would be so visually, you know, complicated and interesting. And so though I didn't know Paul that well, I reached out and said, you know, I would love to collaborate. And so we started to just work kind of very informally over whenever we had time, whenever he had time, whenever I had time. And then he eventually sold a cookbook, which he co-wrote with Andrew Friedman. And some of the work that we had already done ended up in that book. And then we just started to shoot in earnest for the actual book. And that was with Clarkson Potter. And I think that was one that obviously I'm super proud of, and is Paul and Andrew are both very important people in my life and good friends. And so that was really the beginning of developing a relationship with Clarkson Potter at Random House, and just having, you know, a book with a chef of Paul's mm-hmm. caliber. So that was the beginning of it. And then, you know, from there, worked with Mark Forgione and Michael White, who also co-wrote his book with Andrew. And, you know, like anything else, it all just starts to like build upon itself.
Yeah. I remember going to one of your launch parties with Paul mm-hmm. and Andrew yeah. and seeing you guys there, and the book is gorgeous. And
thank you.
I don't know at the time if I realized it was such a new, like cookbooks were so new or at that caliber mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah. I mean, again, like I wasn't, yeah. I just didn't come to this world from a food background or a photography background. It all came after college and after this graduate school program.
Right.
There's a lot to get up to speed on, but fortunately, yeah, it's been great, obviously, to work with.
What's the difference working with, or is there a difference working with all these chefs and also different publishing houses? I've always been curious, like, do they have different, I don't know, rules or?
Yeah, well, I think every publisher has their own way of doing things mm-hmm. and their certain house styles and, you know, obviously different art directors who have different desires and interests. Working with chefs, they are also all very different. But I really enjoy that process. I mean, for me, working on cookbooks, the most fun part is spending some considerable amount of time with a chef and really getting to know their personality and getting to know how they express that through their food and how they operate their kitchen, how they treat their cooks, all of this stuff, and learning the stories behind how they got to where they are. So so that part is always different and interesting to me because it's just a different story each time. The publishers, yeah, they have different ways of working, and it's just a matter of kind of being familiar with what they like or what they don't like. It's all. So far, I've been lucky to work with great publishers, and the, mm-hmm. the output, the end result is always really satisfying.
And what about travel? Because are you doing more travel photography? Or I know you worked in the North book mm-hmm. In Iceland. I was looking on your site at your Iceland pictures because I went to Iceland in March this year.
Great.
It was so beautiful and fantastic, and I was shooting on my iPhone the whole time, and the Northern Lights were very hard to capture on an iPhone. Let me tell you, I got a shot, but I was thinking, your photos are beautiful. But did you tie that trip? I mean, were you there to tell me? Were you there on vacation?
Or
were you there?
No, I was hired. It was definitely. I was hired to work on this book with Gunnar, Chef Gunnar Gislason, who's cooking now at Agern here in the city. Mm-hmm. But also has the restaurant.
I went to Dill's. Yeah, fantastic.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
The book was structured around three visits. So I was there traveling with Gunnar and the co-writer Jody Eddy.
Shout out to Jody.
Yeah. And so we would travel one trip. We would travel like up to the northwest, and then you know shoot all the purveyors and producers that Gunnar worked with and who provided ingredients for all of his recipes. And then we'd come back and then go sort of to the far east of Iceland and kind of trek through the middle. And so each trip was just an exploration of basically the whole island, which was amazing to be able to do that in the
Very
company
amazing.
of mm-hmm. of a chef like Gunnar. And then went back one more time for about a week to do the actual shooting, which we did in Dil, over the course of, I would say, 7 or 8 days, something like that. And that was the project. I think the first like travel thing that I did was with Andrew and Michael White. We went to Italy for Classico e Moderno, and that was also amazing to just be traveling through Bologna and down through the Amalfi Coast with Michael White, who just, when he's there, is just like totally Italian. It's amazing. He just transforms into...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that was so incredible for me to be able to tell the story of Michael's food and his background through, you know, all of these experiences and seeing the landscape and the people that he worked with and the produce and the ingredients and all of this stuff. So that was, you know, one of the first big experiences for me that integrated travel and food. And I've always liked travel. My parents always traveled with us when we were young. Then they never shied away from traveling with me and my brother and sister. So I've always enjoyed that. But that was definitely a place, an instance where I felt like, wow, I can do, explore food through all of this travel with my camera and do that. So since then, there's been north about Iceland and Senegal with Chef Pierre Thiam, where we got to go to Senegal for also 3 visits and really got to see Senegal north to south and east to west. And I've been to Spain with Katie Button and Felix Miana from Curate in Asheville, North Carolina. So, yeah, it's been amazing to be able to do these things.
You know. I'm thinking everyone listening to my show and me, we all want to be you. I love food and travel, but this is like, incredible experiences and opportunities.
So, yeah, the camera is an amazing instrument because it really does open up doors and you get to just experience so much more. Like, it's actually hard for me to travel when I'm not working, because I feel a little bit like aimless. Like, I'm not good at just traveling to relax. So it helps me to have an assignment or something to structure my travel.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that too. It all ties together. And
yeah.
So before we take a break, let me ask you my question I have from my last guest. So in episode 148, I had on Joe Montagnol. He's the CEO and co-founder of Seven Rooms, which is a reservation seating and guest management platform. So he had a very thoughtful question. He wants to know, out of all the places you've been, where do you find food and culture is most intertwined? And he gave an example, like most reflective of each other. And then where do you think it's most disconnected, such as you wouldn't think this culture has this type of food?
That's that's a super tricky question. I mean, I guess when I approach travel and I go to a country, I try not to have any preconceived notions about what that food is supposed to be, I suppose. And I don't know, food is culture in so many ways. So that's how I think that's how a lot of us travel, is to go and eat and sort of say, oh, okay, this country is about, you know, this preparation and then the specifics of each region of any given country, like, is reflected in those dishes. So I don't know how to disentangle those two, food and culture. They just seem so synonymous, basically. So I guess what's interesting, I think, like, on the sort of more, well, like in Iceland, they love hot dogs. They love these crazy hot dogs with like toasted shallots. And it's just like such a big thing there. And I don't remember the backstory as to why hot dogs are such a big thing, but they really are, like,
yeah. I went to that one, one place.
The one in Reykjavik.
I can't pronounce the name.
Nor can I. But but yeah, it's, and I always love, like, going to whatever, convenience stores and sort of seeing, like, strange potato chip flavors that are, like, super local to various regions and countries. That's the kind of, I don't know, that kind of thing is very funny, like, where the culture is being sort of, filtered through this lens of fast food or kind of global, right, product, mm-hmm. whether it be hot dogs or potato chips or soda pop or whatever.
Kit Kats.
Yeah, Japan. Exactly. Right, totally. Yeah. So that kind of stuff is a fascinating explosion of culture and food and the way they interact and relate. But I don't know if I've ever gone to a place and thought like, oh, this doesn't belong here, because I would just think, well, I didn't know that they had this or that they had that, but sure, I guess they do.
All right. You know? I think that's a great answer. Well said. And on that note, let's take another little break here, and then we're going to come back and we're going to play my speed round game and talk industry news. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Linda Liu, host of Feast Meets West on Heritage Radio Network. Feast Meets West traces the stories of your favorite Asian foods, from their origins to what they mean in today's food culture. Tune in on Wednesdays, 8 p.m. to hear my co-host Iris and I interview chefs, restaurateurs, and other food experts about Asian cuisine. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to become a member today.
Okay, we're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Evan Sung. Are you ready for my speed round game?
I hope so.
I think you're going to be great. I'm going to name a couple things and you just pick your preference.
Okay.
Here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail? Wine at this point. Champagne at this point.
Ooh, I'm getting specific. Love it. Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte? I mean, both, I guess. I mean, I can't. A la carte. Why not?
How about small plates or large plates?
Small plates is good.
Communal table or chef's counter?
I'm not such a big fan of communal tables, so let's say chef's counter.
Okay. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
All-inclusive.
Go for the all-inclusive. How about shooting in studio or on location?
On location, generally.
Okay, well, we were talking about that. Not so bad to be in Spain, Italy, and Iceland.
Right.
How about shooting food, landscapes, or portraits, people?
I mean, I guess portraits.
You're still bad. Yeah, still your favorite.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah, because it's the people that make the food, and landscapes are beautiful, but it is kind of like a picture postcard situation, and a person's face is so specific and has so much to tell about the person's character. And
yeah, no, that's a great reason. I love shooting landscapes. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, my Instagram's all food, but it's like every once in a while I put in a nice sunset picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, if you're asking me either or, yeah, then that's, yeah, I'll say portrait, but okay. I like it all.
Yeah. Well, you're good at it all. How about cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Oh, I thought you were asking me about cocktails for a second.
You're not the first to say that. Yeah.
Brooklyn. I mean, I'm born in Manhattan. I grew up in Manhattan,
which is very cool. Yeah, I think
it was definitely a nice place to grow up. But yeah, these days I feel very comfortable where I'm at in Brooklyn, so I'll say Brooklyn.
Okay, great. See, you were great at the game.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay, so for industry news, this week I picked out an article in Bloomberg Pursuits, How Rent Spikes Are Creating Fine Dining Deserts in New York City. This was by Kate Crater and James Tarmey. So this is not an entirely new subject, or we've talked about it on the show, but this article is talking about what's happening in the Union Square area, which changed tremendously from 20 plus years ago, when you had restaurants like Republic, Blue Water Grill, and Union Square Cafe that really, sure, really changed the neighborhood, and it was a very different, not populated like Manhattan, like what it is today. It really put it on the map, and these places are closing. Well, Union Square Cafe has moved, but it has to do with rent increases. But Republic was there for 20 years is closing, mm-hmm. and article is saying, you know, creating these deserts, like what's going to happen now with Union Square? Is it going to go back to being not as much of a hub or you know, place in New York City? Yeah. So,
I mean, I think you see it in a lot of places. You know, like I walk down Smith Street and there are a lot of shuttered mm-hmm. stores yeah. for rent there. And, you know, I think it is this idea that it goes beyond the restaurant industry. I mean, you always see these massive, massive storefronts, like split level, three level storefronts. And you just wonder, like, what company can afford to really operate these spaces that must have just astronomical rents. So the restaurant industry just makes it even harder because the margins are so tight and labor costs, you know, going up, et cetera. So, I don't know what will replace those spaces, and spaces just seem to get larger and larger. And
yeah, I don't know either. I mean, Blue Water Grill, it said the rent is going up to $2 million a year, mm-hmm. and it's an extremely successful restaurant, but mm-hmm. still with that, they're like, how are we, that's like an impossible rent to make mm-hmm. yearly. So I don't know, there's a new Dillon's like candy shop down there, and there's a Starbucks, mm-hmm. and I mean, we'll see, but the rent, yeah, how to make ends meet, and I don't, you know, it was interesting. I was saying this guy, Jonathan Moore, who's the owner of Republic, he's actually, his lease is for another 3.5 years, but he's ending it sooner because he's going to split the difference of the rent increase of what the landlord gets from the new tenant mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. him. So he's going to profit from it a little bit. So he's like getting out early, but I don't know. I don't know what's going to go in. We'll see.
Well, it definitely will. I mean, obviously it creates new neighborhoods elsewhere. That's one side effect.
It's optimistic approach. I like it.
but yes, I it does create these areas where all you have are banks and what else do you have? Banks
Duane
and
Reed's.
Duane Reed's. I mean, I like my Duane Reed, but
you
just end up.
Or some more stores, I guess. Like maybe you get like an H&M or something to go in. I don't know.
Right. But like spaces where you can hang out. You can really linger and spend time, whether it be a restaurant, cafe, or a Barnes & Noble, or, you mm-hmm. know, I still miss Tower Records on 4th Street. I can hang out there for hours and hours and just kind of kill time. So, yeah, the economics of that are really tough, especially in this city. So, I don't know. You do end up with deserts, and that's not ideal. So,
yeah, well, we'll see what happens. I mean, yeah. And be optimistic about it.
And there are always really smart operators who do find ways to kind of make a space work, even in a challenging neighborhood. So
yeah, true. Yeah, the other article I had was on Eater New York, and is entitled "Quiet Restaurants Are for the Rich." In some places, quiet is becoming a luxury amenity. And this was by Deborah First. And this is something also we talked about on the show before with being. I mean, restaurants are typically so noisy and loud, and it's a problem. And this article really highlighted Alex Stupak's new place, Empion, in Midtown, and how, well, he worked with Glenn Coben, who's as a designer, and anticipated the noise issues. And, well, it was interesting. Alex said he didn't want to put in all the sound, the panels at first. He wanted to see what it was like. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they opened and he saw how noisy it was like they went to... Like Glenn was ready with the plan.
Yeah.
And I've dined there upstairs, and I did notice how the volume was great. Mm. It was, you could have a conversation, and so it worked. Mm-hmm. But this article is pointing out how expensive it is to put in these sound acoustic panels and what you put in the ceiling, to do it is very expensive, which is I think why a lot of restaurants don't, and mm-hmm. also a lot of restaurants want the noise.
Right.
So,
right.
I don't know if you have any comment on this.
I mean, I think, sure, of course, in a restaurant, everything is an expense, and so there are decisions to be made about whether to pursue soundproofing, et cetera. But yeah, I think in general, the theory seems correct. A cheaper, more casual place wants that sort of din and that vibe and that energy, and it also kind of just helps for turnaround, right, and getting people in and out. And I think it's just a cultural expectation that if you pay a lot for your meal, some significant amount, that you would be able to dine in peace and quiet but I don't know, something like Empeyon, which is great, and that maybe straddles some sort of middle ground, and I think it has a good noise level to it. Like, it feels energetic when I've been there, and has a great bar scene. And
yeah, I think the bar downstairs definitely is noisy, or it has that energy. It was right when I was upstairs where I noticed, like, you could have a conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not a hushed place, but it is.
No.
But it controls the sound levels.
Yeah, and the article also pointed out Le Cucu, mm-hmm. I think Rita Jamais told me that's how it's pronounced. Uh-huh. But they have the cushions on the banquettes, and they have the drapes on the windows and all, and the carpet and the white tablecloth, like all those things help with noise.
Yeah.
And it's a more sophisticated restaurant, but I think all of that costs money, and then it goes back to the diner of, mm-hmm. you know, you're paying for it. So I don't know. I think maybe New Yorkers or people are getting tired of this. You have to scream in a restaurant,
right,
you know, and more restaurateurs will put in sound, whatever enhancement, so that it's quieter.
Yeah, I mean, I usually I'm okay with noise levels, but yeah, there are definitely some places I've been to recently where I'm like, wow, this is really there's a lot going on right now.
Yeah, you walk out and you realize you'd been shouting for 2 hours.
Yeah,
well, I'm with you. Okay, so we're gonna take one more break. Come back, I'm gonna do my solo dining experience. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter. Tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been spreading honey, won't they? Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. This week it's at Hoppers. Here's the rundown. The location, 49 Frith Street, Soho, London. The concept, family-style Sri Lankan and Tamil Nadu street food inspired cooking, plus inventive cocktails offered in a vibrant, relaxed surroundings. Why did I go? Because the fabulous Kate Crater told me to, and other trusted colleagues. But if Kate says to go, you go. So I did. So my experience, I arrived around 6:30 at this no-reservation restaurant to find a crowd waiting outside for tables. I approached the host, who was taking names and quoting people several hour-long waits, so I was feeling like I wasn't going to get in, but then I said I was a party of one, and what do you know, I was instantly sat at the last seat at a little counter in the center of the restaurant, so I got in immediately just because I was solo. It was a tight space, so I was lucky to be petite, but I was lucky to be in because this place is obviously very popular. So what did I get? I had hot butter deviled shrimps
and an egg hopper, which is an edible bowl made of fermented rice and coconut milk pancake with an egg. You can get a hopper without the egg, but I got it with it. And then I had it with lamb curry, which is their curry. I also had a green papaya crush drink, which was cucumber with green papaya, cucumber, coriander, green chili, and salt lime soda. So my take: flavorful, spicy, unique, delicious, fun, unusual, and it was worth being crammed in for. It was really fantastic food. The ambiance: dark, casual, lively spot, and loud, as we're talking about noise. Perfect for queuing up to satisfy Indian food cravings at a very good value. Interesting tidbit. So this little Soho restaurant is the latest from the Sethis, a family behind London's Michelin-starred Jim Khanna and Trishna. And personal fun fact, I was staying nearby in Soho at the lovely Dean Street townhouse, which was very convenient, and I enjoyed lots of meals in the Soho neighborhood. I also had gone to Barrafina, Kiln, Palomar, and Dishoom. Many of these you have to line up for, too, or lucky to have a reservation, which I did have at Palomar, but the other ones I waited for. I also knew this trend at some of those others with these kitchen bars, which seem to be all over London. I feel maybe we'll see that more in Manhattan. So Hopper's cost was $34. That is converted into U.S. and including everything, tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes, I would definitely go back solo because I think it's easier to get in. Website is hopperslondon.com. What do you think of that?
Sounds great. I'll go next time I'm in London.
All right, cool. Yeah, it was a great spot and a great tip from Kate. Okay, so time for the final question. Next week, I am having on legendary Gail Green, from the Insatiable Critic and the former restaurant critic at New York Magazine. Gail is also the co-founder of City Meals on Wheels, which she co-founded with James Beard. So, Evan, what would you like to ask Gail?
I guess I was thinking she's seen a lot of restaurant changes in the restaurant world, and I think sometimes it's easy to think about, you know, the good old days and how things might have been better before. And we talk about noise level and comfort and things like that. So I would be curious to hear from her. Are there things that she sees in restaurants these days that she actually like applauds and likes? You know, are there new developments that she thinks are really great compared to in the past?
Okay. Great question. I will ask. Yeah. She was in New York Magazine 40 mm-hmm. years. So mm-hmm. yeah, long time.
Yeah. Yeah,
seen a lot. Seen yep. And yep. Also seen a lot with photography, too, you know, of restaurants, I'm thinking.
True, yeah.
Changes.
Yeah. Can't wait for that interview.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, that's the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sherry.
I'm so impressed with everything you've done. I think I love seeing your photos. I just think you do beautiful work.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I look forward to seeing you out in the industry.
Definitely.
and all of your books and photos in the Times and Plus. So my guest today has been Evan Sung. He is a prominent food, lifestyle, and travel photographer. You can find his work at evansung.com, and you can follow him on social media at evansungnyc. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are bayerpublicrelations.com and sherrybayer.com. All of our shows are archived at heritageradionetwork.org, and we are on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks again to Evan and to my show's engineer today, David. I'm Sherry Bayer. I will be back next week with another live show. Hope you'll tune in then. And thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. See heaven.